Dear ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to today's session. It is the second session of our Transatlantic Talks series, which we're organizing together and in collaboration with the Young Transatlantic Initiative. This whole series is also supported by the Austrian. The American, the US American Embassy here in Austria, in Vienna. My name is Michael Sinkernel. I am the director of the Austrian Institute for European and Security Policy, together with the Young Transatlantic Initiative and supported by the US Embassy here in Vienna. We have initiated this series of Transatlantic Talks. This is the second episode of this series, the first one we had back in May, where we did talk about the security aspects of the transatlantic relations. However, today we will be focusing on the US presidential elections. We will have a deep dive into the topic, especially because it is also extremely important for the future transatlantic relations. And therefore, without any further ado, it is my great pleasure to welcome David Kirsch, who is going to moderate today's session. David, you also will introduce our excellent speakers for tonight. I'm looking forward to this very interesting and engaging debate. And therefore, David, I'd like to hand over to you. Thank you very much for co-hosting and co-organizing this event.
Thank you very much, Michael. Dear audience, dear speakers, good evening to you. My name is David Kirsch, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the second episode of the Transatlantic Talks. I also want to extend a heartfelt thank you to all our cooperation partners, including the Austrian Institute for European Security Policy, the Youth Atlantic Treaty Association, and the US Embassy in Vienna, whose support makes this series possible. Together with my co-head, Jannik Heimeder, we serve as the lead of the City Hub in Vienna for the Young Transatlantic Initiative. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to the second episode of the Transatlantic Talks, and I'm honored to be your moderator for tonight. Tonight, as we gather online, we delve into a topic of immense significance, and it's the upcoming US elections. The impact of the US elections on Austria, and indeed on Europe, cannot be overstated. Whether the outcome favors the Republican nominee Donald Trump or the Democratic nominee Kamala Harris,
That's right.
the consequences will be profound. The outcomes of the US elections will shape policies that affect not only global security and economic ties, but also environmental standards that impact our lives directly. This evening, we are set to take a deep dive into the current state of this election and its potential ramifications for transatlantic relations. Just a few words on the format for tonight's discussion. We'll conduct two rounds of questions where each speaker will respond to one question per round. After these two rounds, we'll open the floor to questions from the audience, and you are welcome to submit your questions to the live stream. Now it's a great pleasure for me to present our esteemed speakers for tonight. And I welcome tonight Elmar Thewessen, live from Washington, D.C. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for ZDF German Television and a seasoned journalist who provides deep insights into American politics, especially in this critical election season. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Good evening.
Joining us from Berlin is Julius van der Laar. He's a political consultant and campaign strategist who has been involved in numerous high-profile campaigns, and he will share his unique perspectives on the strategies that shape presidential races. Thank you very much for coming. Knut Detlefsen is with us live from Brussels. He recently transitioned to lead the Future of Work project at the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung after serving for 6 years at the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung representative in North America. Knut offers valuable views on the international implications of US policies and their effects on transatlantic relations. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sergei Lagodinsky, also joining us live from Brussels, is a member of the European Parliament representing the Greens. As the spokesperson on Russia for the Greens group, Sergei has been deeply involved in negotiating all European Parliament resolutions on Russia. His expertise is especially pertinent in the discussions of democracy, digital rights, and Europe's strategic positions on global issues. Thank you very much for coming tonight. And finally, we have Paul Aigner, live from Austria, I think Innsbruck. Paul is a renowned US election analyst who brings a critical data-driven perspective to our understanding of electoral trends and voter behavior. His insights are invaluable, particularly in analyzing swing state dynamics and the broader electoral strategies at play. Thank you very much for coming tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So together, our distinguished panel will provide a comprehensive overview and deep dive into the implications of the upcoming US elections on transatlantic relations. We are set for a night of enriching discussion, and we are grateful you could join us to gain deeper insights into these critical issues. So I'd like to kick off this round with our first question directed to Washington for Elmer Thewissen. So Elmer, please tell us, what is the atmosphere like in Washington, D.C. right now? How does this momentum for Kamala Harris feel? And is it a genuine momentum? Or is it just the same case that we witnessed in 2016?
Well, thank you very much and good evening to everyone. I really am happy that I can be part of that. Thank you for the invitation. Actually, the mood is very, very suspenseful because what people thought maybe 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago was that this race was all but over, that actually the polls, the opinion polls, but also the feeling in the country was that in this election, we have a choice between two old white men, and nobody really liked the choices. As a matter of fact, more than 70% of Americans thought that they are not satisfied with the choices they have, and now everything seems to have changed. It doesn't mean that the outcome of the election is already set, but it means that it is suspenseful again. So I was at the RNC in Wisconsin. I was at the DNC in Chicago a short while ago. And the amazing thing was right after the RNC, we all had the feeling that this is done. I mean, Donald Trump will win this election, no question about it. And then only a few weeks later, the mood has changed entirely because all of a sudden, it seems possible that Kamala Harris can win the election. Most of what we see right now in the mood, which is on the Democratic side, a joyful mood, a mood that it is not really a dark thing that is lying in front of us. It is an election where we can make choices in a positive way. And the Democrats are trying to frame it in the way of future, freedom, and joy. Those are the three buzzwords or keywords on the Democratic side. And nobody would have thought that things could change so quickly for the Republican side after the RNC. But now it's interesting, of course, to keep in mind things can change as quickly again in the next couple of weeks, because the reason Kamala Harris is riding this wave right now is that people really came out of this big, deep hole of desperation, I would call it. And everybody was happy that they have a more brighter, joyful choice now. And that was reinforced by Kamala Harris and Tim Walz when they are out on the campaign trail. But the big question is whether they can sustain this kind of mood and wave that is carrying them right now until November 5th and maybe even beyond, depending on what happens on November 5th. Which means that right now they seem to have the momentum. The lead is widening in the opinion polls in the country, and I have some doubts about polls anyway, and I'd be happy to dig into that deeper later on, because most of the polls are based on a very low number of people that are questioned in those polls. But as you can see, the dynamic is on the Democratic side, and I think it depends on how she can, in the country, specifically in the big swing states, the seven big swing states that will decide this election, if she can reach the audiences that make that difference, which is the young people, the women, the Black vote, and the Latino vote. Right now, she is ahead in all of those, in all polls here in the United States, in the national polls, and also in most of the swing states, not in all of them. But this is something that, as I explained, can change very quickly. So to make a long story short, it is as suspenseful as it hasn't been in a very, very long time. And we might see a very, very close election, therefore, on November 5th.
Thank you very much for this already very interesting talk. I'd like to wrap up one point you mentioned and move forward with a question for Julius van der Laar. From a campaigning standpoint, after the sudden announcement of Joe Biden's resignation, a completely new campaign seems to have sprung up overnight. How do you assess this rapid transformation for the Democrats? Has Kamala Harris definitely turned the campaign around, securing full support from her party?
Well, let me just say, thanks for having me. This is wonderful. And did she turn it around? I would say absolutely. I mean, the campaign prior to Kamala Harris joining as the top of the ticket was basically the Titanic on the bottom of the ocean. There was nothing left, no shimmer of hope. And I think she came in, obviously, and the campaign took off. What Elmer just described is the same thing that I witnessed. You know, campaign takes off, and I would imagine that, you know, in the first couple of days, Kamala Harris swoops in, she talks to the team. But it wasn't really the campaign that got it turned around. It was mostly volunteers, people who were excited, the Brad Summer that took off, until the campaign actually swooped in. I think they've done a pretty good job making sure that they don't damp the momentum. I think there's always a big risk if there's such excitement out in the country. Obviously, people, just as Elma mentioned, being happy that there's a different choice than the one they had before. There's always the danger that a campaign tries to sort of overtake it and almost throws a wet blanket on top of it and puts out the fire. And I think they've been pretty successful in not making sure that it's happening. So I would say that the campaign has basically done everything right up to this point. I was in Chicago. The convention was tremendous. I think there was one piece that was misled when they didn't completely kill the Beyonce story. I think that was a big mistake. If I had been the campaign, I'd probably have been out there in that morning and saying, she's absolutely not coming. Let's stop talking about Beyonce. But again, overall, I think they've done a lot of things right. But I will also say, and I think we've all heard that, you know, that there was a general narrative that Kamala Harris is still sort of the witness protection or the candidate protection program candidate, where she's not out there, she's not giving interviews. That was sort of the talking point on Fox News, on many other channels. Donald Trump kept repeating it. And now, of course, she did the big interview last week. I think it was 16 minutes, so it wasn't quite that big. And she had Tim Walz sitting next to her. I think there's one danger, and as Emma mentioned, she's ahead in a lot of polls. Obviously, momentum is changing. Big difficulty that most campaigns run into when you're ahead, you sort of slam on the brakes and you say, well, let's not go into any risk. And I would say, keep that momentum going. Be offensive, be aggressive, continue to be that way, especially since the first debate is coming up in just a few days. So I would say to Kamala Harris and her campaign, that momentum is out there. Make sure you continue to stoke that fire. Don't be irresponsible or reckless, but don't just sort of play it safe or try to play it safe. That's usually a disaster. Let me just say last thing. Campaigns, you know, every campaign is different, but when we talk about momentum, let's break it down what momentum actually means. I think it's always a question of message, money, and mobilization. And, you know, the mobilization clearly is out there. People are turning out to the rallies, something completely that Joe Biden hasn't had before. The money is pouring in. Remember those first 24 hours, and now a month later, she's raised close to $500 million. So obviously, money's pouring in too. And for the first time in a very long time, Democrats have a message again. Again, future versus the past, joy and energy versus darkness, right? So there's a lot there. And I think that's a wave that Kamala Harris, if she doesn't screw it up and continues to push forward, I think she can very well ride into November and then, of course, into a victorious election. But it's not over yet.
Thank you very much, Julius van der Laar. I'd like to follow up with Knut Detlefsen and talk about messaging and content as well. In a previous interview, you mentioned that only Biden can defeat Trump and emphasized the importance of Biden highlighting his accomplishments for the middle class. So given the recent developments and, of course, Biden's resignation, is Kamala Harris effectively positioning herself as the continuation of Biden's legacy, particularly regarding policies benefiting the middle class, and how is she articulating her vision for America's future?
Well, I would say that she is very well positioned, and she, of course, was prepared for that move. I mean, she didn't know it was coming. I mean, but she was, prepared for that move because it was something in the weeks leading up to the decision of Biden, as you remember, I mean, everybody is probably in this conversation has followed it very closely. It was obvious that there are only two choices, either and only Joe Biden could make that choice to be to make it a successful transition. That Biden had to make the choice to give room to a different candidate, and there was only one candidate really that could take over, and that was Kamala Harris, and she knew that. And everybody who was influencing that decision knew that too and was pushing for that. I mean, the most important people for that, or the most important person was probably Nancy Pelosi, but also people like Congressman Clyburn and also people like President Obama were, of course, very influential. And you could see that also at the Democratic Convention, how Joe Biden did not embrace those people in the convention. So, and I also want to make clear that I gave that interview in January when I was, I meant to say he is the only one that can stop Donald Trump now because the Republicans have made the decision. But I do believe that the content matters. Joe Biden's presidency was a successful presidency. But the main problem that Joe Biden had as a candidate was his age. And that did obviously not go away. And then with a terrible performance in the presidential debate, he was not able to continue. And it took him a while to realize that. Now, he had also another very big big disadvantage that he felt very uncomfortable to talk about abortion. And that is, of course, always a bit surprising for German observers, but abortion or the right to decide for women what they want to do, and that's what how it is framed. You know, the women can decide, have the freedom to decide what will happen to their body. Is, of course, something that is something that Joe Biden felt very uncomfortable talking about. As an old man, as a Catholic, and something he was at the end of the day probably not fully convinced of. Now, Kamala Harris is very well positioned and does talk very competent about it. The other frame that is very important when we talk about crime, which is another important topic, Kamala Harris is very well positioned as a former prosecutor to talk about crime and fighting crime. But at the same time, not overdoing it. It is something very important to know that the people that are most concerned about crime are actually Afro-American voters. And they are concerned about crime, but also about at the same time overdoing it. And so that's why at the same time, it's important that, you know, Trump would pose a real risk of having a way dealing with crime that would be very negative for many parts of the American population. And then there's one benefit that, I mean, the vice president is not so much associated with the negative aspects that people perceive in the economy. She is not seen as being responsible for inflation. And she can, together with Tim Walz, portray herself as someone that she will fight for the working people, the working middle class, and can finish the Biden agenda that Biden was not able to push through because he didn't have the majorities. And that's why Tim Walz, I think, is very important as a candidate. Not that he will probably bring many percentage points. A vice presidential candidate does not really influence in a big way the decision of voters. But he sets the stage for a presidential agenda of Joe Biden, of Kamala Harris taking over from Joe Biden in that direction where Joe Biden wanted to go but couldn't go. And I think she will be able in the remaining time not to lay this out in great detail, but make clear that she is the presidential candidate that will fight for the middle class and will make change in a way that will make a difference. By, for instance, I want to give like a few examples, because what she's not an ideal someone that will, she will focus on real political measures that will make a difference. Like, for instance, tax breaks for children that will be for many people very important. And that was something of the Biden agenda, but which had to, they couldn't keep because they couldn't get it through Congress. And things like that. And Tim Walz is someone, as a governor, he did make real change in his state for, and for instance, through school meals and other things that made a difference in people's daily lives. And I think Tim Walz is an indicator that she wants to go in this direction and that she will also make this agenda. And this focusing on the middle class is, of course, very important. Which is like, say one more thing and then I will stop, because it is what she manages right now to do, and that's why I feel actually very positive about the outcome of the election. She's rebuilding the Biden coalition that won the election in 2020. She's close to having it again. And I think she's very well positioned to to have a big victory, while Donald Trump, and in particular also his vice presidential candidate, are really a little bit falling behind, because they really seem to be out of touch with their goals. You know, if they want to push, convince black women, black men to vote for Donald Trump, it's not a very good idea to question if Kamala Harris is black. And that's not a winning strategy. And the other team just makes so many mistakes that is in a way the advantage. And if you listen to Democrats these days, and I mean, I left the U.S. two weeks ago, and I still talk to my Democratic friends. I think everybody is aware that the election is not over. They need to fight until the end. Everybody's stressing on that. So that's why I feel actually very optimistic about that election.
Thank you so much. It's very interesting. And now let's dig even deeper into policies and bring in Mr. Sergei Lagodinsky to talk about foreign policy. You have a profound understanding of the region of Russia and Ukraine, and also on foreign policy aspects of the of a possible second Donald Trump presidency on U.S. foreign policy, and particularly regarding Russia and this prolonged conflict in Ukraine. What changes or continuities might you expect from a second Donald Trump presidency?
Yo, good to have a, thank you very much, first of all, and nice to see familiar faces, both from Washington, but also Julius and Elmar, nice to see you as well. And Knut, welcome back. Or welcome back to Europe and welcome to Brussels. It's great to hear that you're here now. I'm not only responsible for Russia policies and in our group. I'm also for 5 years was the chair of the EU Turkey delegation, and was also coordinating many other aspects, also on rule of law. So this is basically a package that makes the elections, of course, the upcoming elections, so important and so interesting from the perspective of Brussels. I would say that from the position of Kremlin, thankfully, I don't know how Kremlin thinks. I'm not too close to the heads and to what is going on in the head of Putin. But from what we have been observing, from what I've been observing, it's a trade-off. It's a trade-off that they will have to make. Between, on the one hand, the uncertainty of Trump administration, and this is something that very many observers say that for Putin and people around Putin, it's not a given that Trump is better, precisely because he's so unpredictable and because it's very difficult to deal with characters like him. Also for Putin, but I think the other side of this equation. And of this balance is a power game politics that Trump classically embodies. And this is a trade-off. I mean, for playing of the push towards power politics in disguise of multilateralism. multilateralism, despite the term as it sounds, which means or infers that it is more democratic and more kind of open towards smaller players, is not what it is in the understanding of Putin. For Putin, multilateralism is basically an assault on transatlantic alliance, its values, and its cooperation. Not because of the United States end of this alliance, but because of the European, the other end of this alliance. And this is the third point that I think would be beneficial for Kremlin, is not so much Trump's attitude towards the world or towards Ukraine, because even there, if you see how the advisors of Trump are talking about the Ukrainian situation, they are not positioning themselves on just on one side. They are saying they would also put Russia under pressure. But the position and the relationship of Trump and his team vis-a-vis Europe, the view how they see Europe, including European values and European reliability or unreliability from their perspective, this is something that resonates with Kremlin. This is something that makes Trump into an asset in many meanings of this term for Kremlin. And I think from that perspective, of course, it's very difficult to read Kamala Harris. I think, I mean, it's not very difficult, but it's not quite easy to read Kamala Harris from the foreign policy perspective, because many details are not clear yet, at least for me. Of course, we have Phil Gordon and many others whom we know, who are known faces. But we don't know on which junctures where the shadings of this foreign policy will be made. But I think it is very clear that the transatlantic alliance, the tradition of transatlantic alliance, will probably be continued. And from that perspective alone, for people like Putin, this is an option which is less attractive and less interesting in the midterm and long term.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lagodinsky. It's very interesting to talk with you about Russia, and I want to shift our focus for the next question about data. And so we come to Paul Eigner. Paul Eigner, I'm a huge fan of your data analytics of the US elections. And with great depth, you analyze on a daily basis the unfolding trends. So please, could you provide an update on the ongoing polling situation? Who's currently leading? How do you assess the status quo of both candidates' campaigns?
Well, I'd like to add something to what Mr. Teveson said in the beginning, because it's important for the European understanding. People in Europe are often surprised when they hear that even white women are voting Republican in the close majority, but still in the majority. So we're talking about a close election for one reason. The reason is that black people and black and Latino women are voting for Democrats and for Democratic candidates in huge portions. If only white men, so like the seven of us here, would vote, it would not be a close election at all. I think that's important to understand the electoral trends, because the states that came back to Kamala Harris's column now, and that are close other than with the candidate Biden, the so-called Sun Belt, so those four states in the South that Biden, some of them won, North Carolina, he lost closely, but those states came back because those demographic groups, young people, black people and women, like Mr. Davison said in the beginning, they were not enthusiastic about Biden anymore, but they are pretty enthusiastic about Harris. Even more, since the candidacy shifted from Biden to Harris, men shifted even more towards Trump, plus 8 points in the last Quinnipiac poll, but women shifted 11 points towards the Democrats. So you have a huge gap, not only in the regional perspective, but also in the gender perspective, that is even widening under the new circumstances. So this is why we have seven swing states at the moment. Funnily, it's the same seven swing states as in 2020. It's not the same swing states as Biden would have had. Biden had only one path to the majority. That would have been through the three blue wall states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And Harris has multiple paths. In the combination of those of those seven swing states, although Pennsylvania is the biggest prize. So the likelihood to win the White House without Pennsylvania is under 10% for both candidates at the moment. So you really gotta have to win Pennsylvania. Harris might switch it with Georgia, which is the reason for that is that the black enthusiasm is pretty big there and could make a difference. But you have the Biden 2020 map for Harris in 2024. And the main reason is that it will be up to women, most of all, to save the American democracy once more.
Thank you very much. I think that was already a very insightful first round with some fascinating perspectives on the current political dynamics. And I'm looking forward to our next round. And to the audience, feel free to comment in the live stream on YouTube for any questions. We will take them on later. And let's transition to our second round of questions. And let's start with Julius van der Laar, because he has to sadly leave us in a few minutes, I guess.
It feels like you're a debate moderator, laying out the terms of the debate. I would like to welcome all the debaters. Here's the first round, the second round of foreign policy. Let's get into it.
I've been binge-watching U.S. election debates in the last days. You got me, yeah, that's right. So, Julius, after prolonged speculations, and we already talked about it, we mentioned it, Kamala Harris has chosen Tim Walz as her running mate. And considering the current political climate, do you believe a moderate Republican, maybe to like Marco Rubio or someone like him, would be a more suitable vice presidential candidate for Trump than someone like J.D. Vance?
Well, let me go back to Milwaukee. The Republican convention back then, it seemed like it was more like a victory party than a party convention. And I think in that spirit, they selected J.D. Vance because they said, well, we're going to just double down on the white working class male. We're going to try to get J.D. Vance, not because of Ohio. It's not a swing state, of course, anymore. But we're just trying to sort of nail the white working class vote. And obviously, J.D. Vance didn't turn out to be the best campaigner. I think the vetting process, you know, how candidates go through reams and binders of information. I think it's a fair guess to say that Donald Trump didn't read every single page of the briefing and vetting material about J.D. Vance. And it turns out it might quite bite them in the ass at this moment. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on the embassy live stream, but I just did. So I don't think it was the smartest choice, at least from this vantage point right now. Things might change, but if he hadn't called Nikki Haley bird brain, maybe that would have been a better option to have selected Nikki Haley, especially when it comes to women or moderates who are flocking away, obviously, tempted at the choice of having someone else, neither Joe Biden nor Donald Trump. So I don't think they're too happy right now about J.D. Vance and the style of Donald Trump. I could even see him run another episode of The Celebrity Apprentice and maybe just do a rerun of making sure that everyone shows up at Mar-a-Lago again, and he might substitute him. Only difficulty with that is that we're about to start printing ballots, and it would be kind of awkward if J.D. Vance was still on the ballot while actually someone else is Donald Trump's running mate. So having said that, flipping over to the Democratic side, obviously Tim Walz, I was standing just a few feet away from the stage when he took the stage at the Democratic National Convention. Boy, it was crazy. People are excited and fired up about Tim Walz. And he isn't the sleekest communicator, of course. He is no Kennedy or Barack Obama in his appearance, but he's able to connect. And so I think it was a smart choice. And I would imagine that most of us probably didn't have him at the top of the list, Tim Walz, that is. I think most people had to Google who actually Tim Walz is and what exactly he stands for. But I think there's one thing, and love sort of the imagery. And you can see how Tim Walz, when you have a flat tire, David, you know, that he comes out and he actually changes your tire on your F-150 pickup truck. And I think every other candidate at the Democratic National Convention was not able to do that. And there's also another part, right? The Democratic Party is positioning itself as the party of the working class. And every single speaker out there is a millionaire, almost billionaire. I mean, Oprah Winfrey, the Obamas, Kamala Harris, basically everyone who was up on that stage, I mean, is completely set for life. And then you have Tim Walz, who doesn't own a single stock, who makes $250K a year, lives in the governor's mansion, but he is not set for life. So I think he has an ability to connect with people that actually makes sense. Now, I love what Paul said about the likelihood of someone being able to win the White House without winning Pennsylvania. And I think that is still one of the very close states, and Kamala Harris still has to do major work, maybe not in Philly, but especially in the suburbs where Democrats have often struggled. And so I think it, you could still make the argument that maybe Josh Shapiro, in terms of winning that one particular state, could have actually helped her. At the same time, I think he is a tremendous rhetorician. I've seen him multiple times over at the DNC where he spoke. And I think the one question that the Kamala Harris campaign may have had is, does he actually outshine the top of the ticket? And I don't think that is rhetorically the danger of having nominated Tim Walz. Hope that answers your question, David.
Answered it perfectly. Thank you very much. Let me talk about, and you mentioned it, like uniting the U.S. Americans. And let me turn now to...
Let me just chime in. Walz, thank you so much for having me. Good to see you all. And again, thanks for having me. So have a wonderful pre-election night tonight. Take care.
Thank you very much for having us. So my next question, Mr. Teveson, talking about unity and your book, The Destruction of America, released in 2022, highlighting the deep divisions within the U.S. And in your view, has Joe Biden been able to address these divisions effectively? And is Kamala Harris capable of uniting the American people again?
I think what Joe Biden was trying to do to come up with programs and actions in order to change the paradigm in the U.S., because the polarization has been so deep for quite some time that it's hardly possible to convince people by just talking to them. You need to do something for them, and mostly for the people across the country who got the feeling that they got the worst end of globalization, that they lost their jobs, that they are desperate about their futures, that the politicians were not paying attention to what they really needed and wanted, and so on. And I think without telling them that neoliberalism has brought us into a big mess over the past decades, without talking about those abstract things, what kind of economic policies do we need for the future, he tried to start doing things, which is what he did with the three big packages that Congress passed, sometimes with the decisive vote of Kamala Harris. She cast the vote as the president of the Senate, of course, as vice president of the U.S. And those programs are starting to unfold effectiveness, not enough before the election. But if you drive through the country, and we have done that, and we will do that starting this week again or over the next couple of weeks, you see areas that were basically run down entirely, where big factories had closed, where people lost jobs, where there was desperation everywhere, where now big factories are being built for semiconductors, for batteries, for electric vehicles, for windmills, for ships that actually are maintaining the windmills, the offshore wind parks, and so on. So America manufacturing, America is coming back. And that is something that has an impact on people's lives immediately without the theoretical, theories coming along with that. So I think he started something that Kamala Harris could build on if she is elected. And the funniest part or the strangest part for me is that Donald Trump has used this feeling of, you know, being called the deplorables by Hillary Clinton to attract so many voters that used to be Democratic voters, the so-called blue wall. And he has succeeded in doing so, getting them behind him. And they made up the bigger part of the 74 million that voted for Donald Trump in 2020. The strange thing in that is that his policies, as he has displayed from 2016 to 2020, were not really in favor of exactly those people who voted him into office. And still, he has a huge number of followers among those people, even though he hasn't delivered, and even though he is promising the same things again, but has a bad record in fulfilling those promises. So the interesting thing for me will be if Kamala Harris is able to not only continue to deliver if she is elected, but also if she can consolidate that in the long run to convince people that this is a goodbye to the neoliberalism that we have seen over the past decades. And the funny thing is that J.D. Vance is running on being the candidate for the people, being the candidate as vice presidential candidate for the blue-collar workers in the U.S. But what J.D. Vance is standing for, what he's voting for, what he wants to do is to free the economy and the big business people from government interference. That's the reason why Peter Thiel is supporting him in a big way. Elon Musk is supporting him in a big way. And if you read the fine print of what J.D. Vance has said over the past 10 years, or just look at the last 5 years, in 21, he called for the destruction of government as we know it, getting rid of all those bureaucrats in the government that seems to put the brakes on economic development and so on. So he is the free market pope and not the blue-collar advocate that he portrays himself to be. And it will be very interesting to see whether Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are able to reveal that during the election campaign in the way that people really find her and Walz more credible than Donald Trump and J.D. Vance.
Thank you very much. Let's just continue assuming Kamala Harris wins the election. And the next question goes to Knut Detlefsen. What implications might her presidency have for German-American relations, especially in contrast to those under Donald Trump?
If Donald Trump had been would be elected, it would be very negative for German-American, European-American elections. I think it would also be, the main thing is it would be very negative for the development of the United States of America. I mean, he would have a very destructive effect on the U.S. His second presidency would be very bad for the U.S. So. That having said, I think it's very important to see that, to continue on the conversation you were having, we were having before, is the chances of that if, no, I would have framed it differently. If Donald Trump is defeated, it is really also in the long run a big deal, because maybe Trumpism isn't finished, but Donald Trump is then finished, because then he cannot. It's very unlikely that he will run again in 4 years, and it might open up the possibility for the Republican Party also to move in a different direction. That's of course not for sure, but there is at least the possibility. As you might know or not know, there is a group. But there are Republicans that are organized, not only in Washington D.C. but in other parts. The Never Trumpers, they always said to me, I was in close contact with them when I was in Washington D.C. That they believe that Donald Trump needs to lose twice for them to have a chance again to reclaim the Republican Party, to make it not the same party that it used to be, but at least a party that is more serious about policy. Because right now, the Republican Party is not there to solve any problems. It's not about any programs or anything. It's the party of, not even of free markets. They are the party of big business, big money, and because Donald Trump favors people who have a lot of money. And that's why some people who have a lot of money support Donald Trump. And Tim Walz is, I mean, Tim Walz is real. And that's the difference to J.D. Vance. Tim Walz is really a person that knows where people's problems are and is there, is a very interesting progressive, or you could also see left-wing politician. And he is basically doing what Olaf Scholz put in his 2021 campaign, respect. He respects people. He also respects people that vote for Donald Trump. He does not demonize people that vote for Donald Trump. And it's very important. And that's why with him, Kamala Harris, I think, has a chance to build bridges in the society. But it's very important what Elmar Thewissen said, I think, that it has to be real, you know, and that you have to invest in the people and in the areas that are disenfranchised. And Joe Biden did do this in a very meaningful way. If you go to Pennsylvania, if you go to other places, the investments that the federal government put into place are working. And it is also important for questions like climate change, because what the goal of the Inflation Reduction Act is to rebuild the American economy into a carbon neutral direction. And that is, of course, important for the world, and it's important for Europe. And I believe, I'm a social democrat, and I think like Tim Walz is really good news for European social democrats, because that's as close as you can get to a social democratic politician in the US, and he will push the presidency into a very progressive, pro-working class, pro-also union agenda, but also in a non-ideological way to focus on results and not on ideology. And that is, you know, from a progressive perspective, very good. On foreign policy, you know, I think Sergei Lagoginsky is very right. We really don't know that much about where they will position themselves exactly. But from what I read and about people who comment and who are a bit closer, is that they will be fairly pragmatic. But they will probably expect more from Germany and more from Europe. And that doesn't mean only, I think they will be a little bit less focused on defense, but more also on other things, but on leadership, on real leadership, you know, on political leadership. And that will, of course, be a challenge for the German government, I think, and probably also for the European Union. But I think that is something when we think about how do we want to get ready, I think we have to be ready that if Kamala Harris and Tim Walz become president and vice president and will build a new administration, that they will expect something from us, and that we will together help to rebuild international institutions and also invest in that with political capital and with financial contributions. And obviously the world will be as complicated as it's now with all its conflict, and there is no magic solution to it, but and Germany and the European Union are needed for that, and that's the positive thing. We have a possibility to continue to work together with the Americans on a positive agenda, and that's why I feel excited about the prospect of them being elected, and hope that that will materialize on the 5th of November.
Thank you very much for these very interesting insights, and I want to continue by bringing Sergei Lagodinsky inside of our discussion. And it was already mentioned, the support of notable tech billionaires like Elon Musk and Peter Thiel, who have shown strong support for Donald Trump. And I think it was Pete Buttigieg who once remarked that rich people vote for people who make rich people even richer. So my question is, do you see a direct link between this support and Trump's deregulation policies, maybe particularly in digital markets and technologies?
Well, I, first of all, I, as someone who grew up in the Soviet Union, and do not belong to those who make rich people responsible for all the evil of the world. Some rich people actually vote in the right way, and they spend the money in the right way. But the particular rich people we're talking about here, they belong to a certain technological elite, which has demonstrated an interesting development, which I think has not only to do something with money, but also with the power of technology and with the structural the structural momentum that we are witnessing now. And I would especially mention a couple of points. Number one, there is a certain momentum for a tech libertarianism, which positions itself, interestingly, in opposition to liberalism, in both in American and in European sense of liberalism, which sees liberalism as something which is weak, which restrains the anything goes developments, and with minority protections, with all the cultural war terms that that they see fit. Number two is the I do think it is important that the tech oligopolism, because for those people, and this is interestingly, I was thinking now, and a kind of a parallel mindset to kind of the Putin multilateralism. It is okay to have others as long as they are, the others are strong figures with whom you can divide the cake. And anything that endangers a certain amount of concentration of power to a sufficient degree. It doesn't have to be monopoly, but it should be oligopoly. And this is something that where regulations, from their perspective, play a negative role, because regulation is about restriction. Regulation is about certain investments and also spending money, and this is something that restrains them. And this is something where they, of course, think the way Trump thinks. He plays the same tune. And connected to that, there is a certain tech anti-Europeanism for both of the aforementioned reasons, because Europe is connected to certain values that are not just that are liberal but not libertarians, and Europe is connected to the issues of regulation. And this is what we are identified with as someone who negotiated the AI Act and Data Governance Act, etc. I see this, I sense this. This is something that is not limited just to our American partners. It's also a sense that is widespread now, increasingly widespread also in Europe. We know this from the German debates in the sense of overregulating. Yes, I think there is a danger of overregulation, but some regulation is okay. For many of those people, any regulation is bad. And this is where they come together and get together with at least kind of the populist Trumpist version of Trump, because I don't think that Trump is against regulation, but he, of course, sells it in a way of a culture war against anyone who wants regulation, anyone who wants liberalism, and anyone who wants transatlanticism. And this is where they come together, where they get together, and polarize the debate. And quite frankly, and I will end on that point, even polarization is something that they need. They need polarization of this debate in order to be successful platforms. They need polarization of this debate in order to satisfy their algorithms. This is also an additional point, even for Elon Musk. You know, we know that he was not always like this. He did not frame issues always like this. But now with it is, of course, also kind of a game of polarization that benefits this particular type of capitalism that Trump also will support from their perspective. So these are a couple of points that I think are important. Unfortunately, I have to leave for my next discussion, my next debate. Thank you very much. I'm always happy to be part of these debates, and let's reconnect maybe before or after the elections, and we'll see whether what we were saying here was relevant or not. All the best.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
Great. So let's now conclude to with our last question from my side to Paul Eigner. And we talked about swing states already, and I want to ask if you have any answer on this or any thoughts on this. With vice presidential candidates Tim Walz and J.D. Vance now announced, how might their selections impact voter preferences in this case, swing states for the upcoming election?
Well, that gives me the chance to mention something that we haven't talked about in an hour now, which is okay, but I think it's necessary to talk also about the Supreme Court and about the decisions that are going to be made by the Supreme Court, because we had that stream in our discussion where you don't really know what Republicans stand for. Well, we do know what they stand for in this perspective, because they reshaped the Supreme Court in a 20-year-long campaign and tried to get a majority there to, first of all, to bring Roe v. Wade to fall, which they did in 2022. And there's another. There's a lot of other rights that are on the line with the majority they are having right now, and that also motivates voters in those critical swing states, because in every close election you gotta keep in mind everyone who might make a difference, and a lot of people that could make a difference these times are Romney, Youngkin, Republican women in the suburbs, who are aligned with many Republican positions, but not with their self-determination and with what they are able and allowed to do with their body. And we're not only talking abortion here, but also contraception, also IVF, because those things are on the line with the majority on the Supreme Court they are having right now. And let's also not forget that when Justice Sotomayor might be incapable of doing her duties in the next 5 years, and Trump wins, and Democrats lose the Senate, then there is another Supreme Court seat. It would be the seventh Supreme Court seat of nine that could be filled by Trump and a Republican majority in the Supreme Court then. So I think that's an issue that's important, also because I mentioned the critical role that women play in those elections, and that their swing vote might determine who is going to end up in the White House in January. So I think that's an important thing. And the other thing that I'd like to add is many people who work for Democratic campaigns that I'm aligned with, and I talk with some of them, they say that it's so funny that the perspective on for the blue wall states is always on those white working class men, when at the same time we know that working class white women have a much bigger swing in their vote than men. And also that the regions that they are looking at in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania and in Michigan, is not Scranton, Pennsylvania, where Joe Biden comes from, but what they are looking at is what do black kids in Detroit, in Milwaukee, and in Philly, are they going to vote or not? Those are tens to hundreds of thousands of people that are sometimes voting and sometimes they are not voting. So some of them say that the perspective on those white working class men, even in those states that are said to be most of all white working class, is not what they are looking for. They are looking to register every single black kid that they can register in those three big towns. And even in the white states in the Rust Belt, blacks are going to have a very important role in determining who gets to 50 and who gets to 48%. This is something that I would like to add also because we are so much focusing on the same Rust Belt stories for such a long time. I know they matter. I know those towns have been bigger 20, 30, 40 years ago. It's clear that you go there for your reporting. But I think there are some regions inside Philly and Detroit and Milwaukee that might be covered a little more too.
Thank you very much. This brings us to the end of our second and final round of questions. We've covered a lot of ground and gained some deep insights into the pressing issues surrounding the upcoming US elections and their potential impact on transatlantic relations. I'd like to thank our speakers for their very thoughtful contributions. And I'd like to take two interesting questions from the audience we received. And the first one is directed at our panelists. And it goes like, how likely or great do you think the danger is that Kamala Harris will get more votes, but Trump will still win as he did against Hillary Clinton because of the majority voting system in the USA? And analyzing your behavior or your look, I'd like to ask Elmar Theveson if you have any thoughts on this.
Well, I think our data expert knows much more about it, but the chance is big that this could happen. If it is a close call, I think there's no question that Donald Trump has no chance to win, in my view, the absolute vote in the US, the popular vote. The majority of people in the US is set against Donald Trump. That is my, not my feeling, I read it from the data that is there. But of course he has a chance, depending on which state, swing states he wins, to win the election with the electoral system that we have in the US. And I think the big question would be if it is gonna be a close election. Either way, we might see some trouble afterwards, because we know that on a local level, the Republicans have staffed the local election boards in a way and also changed the laws in some states. Georgia is an example for that, where all of a sudden partisan people are in charge of deciding who they give the election to. So even though in the big numbers, the national numbers, it looks like one winner, we might have some trouble decide what happened on a local and regional level in some of the states. So we might have even the worst situation than last time, where it took 4 days to come up with the final results. It might take more time, and it is fertile ground to question the election results in a big way. So the thing that everybody would hope for is a decisive victory for either side. I would argue better for the yes, it would be if Harris wins big time. And I don't think that 306 to 232, like last time, is enough to constitute a big victory. It would have to be more, and I don't know if it's possible. Having said that, I think I'm very curious about what the data expert, Paul, what you are saying about this, because it might be really crunch time in the days after the election.
Yeah, I'm taking that. So to explain even more clearly what Mr. Theveson just mentioned is, so in Georgia, they staffed the local election boards with majority Trump Republicans against the will of the regional Republican government of Georgia, Governor Kemp, Secretary Raffensperger. They even protested actively and publicly against that move, because the move would make it possible for a local election board of one of the 30 or 40 counties to say that they don't have a result yet. So the government of Georgia cannot report their result to DC. So there is no final result in DC. And what happens if those cases are not clear and cannot be cleared politically? Then it goes to the Supreme Court, which is back to my last part. You know how the Supreme Court is composed at the moment. So this is really, really a big problem that we're facing here. And you can imagine the intensity of the tries to fake the elections in Georgia from the Trump Republican side, when you see how intensely those protests by the governor and by the secretary of state of Georgia are protesting against their own presidential candidate. So that's for one. The other thing is the statistical likelihood of a Trump White House without winning the popular vote is pretty big, at 1 to 2%, and so like Nate Silver, who I wouldn't trust on most of the things, but here it's pretty clear because he has a long record. He says that 2.5% is the 50-50 mark. So if Harris wins by 3, she's pretty likely the next president. If she wins only by 2, the likelihood that Trump is winning the White House is more likely than that Harris is going to win. So for a clear Harris win in the Electoral College, you need 3.5, 4 or more percent to her benefit on the national level. Are we going to get those results? First of all, we don't know it, because if you look at the last couple of months, you know that in politics a week is a lifetime. after Trump was shot, everybody said, okay, the election is over. He's going to anyway. One later, Biden changed to Harris. Harris had a good start. Everybody said, oh, boy, Harris is rising in the polls. The rise is not going to stop. She's going to win it anyways. Forget about that. We're going to have a lot of twists and turns until November. We don't know anything at the moment. And we are exactly in the 50-50 area with a 3 points advantage of the Harris-Waltz campaign. So it's pretty much 50-50 right now.
Yeah, but I would say I would actually say I see that a little bit different because now the momentum of the Democrats, let's say the Democrats, and I think that the it's important to remember it's not only a presidential election, we also have congressional elections and governor's elections, and generally the trend I think is now really favoring the Democrats. Also, you know, the approval ratings are high for governors, Democratic governors on the ballot, not on the ballot, and also the approval ratings of Harris and Waltz are very good. So the trend is really at this very moment, of course the trend can change, but the trend is important in campaigns and if you run campaigns. And if the trend on the other side is negative, think of Laschet, think also if you want to Martin Schulz, if you want to use a social democrat, if the trend is negative, it's sometimes very difficult to break the negative trend. And that's why I think, I mean, Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are in a good position to actually win this election decisively, also because the other side is making many mistakes. In Georgia, for instance, I mean, what does Trump use his time on to attack a popular Republican governor? It's probably not the smartest way to win a state. And you mentioned it yourself. I mean, in Arizona, abortion rights are going to play a big role. There's a whole ballot initiative in Arizona on it. And the Democrats are very well positioned to win Wisconsin. And the other thing that is very important is, of course, the majority of the working class in the U.S. is not white. The majority of the working class is Latino and Black. But it's actually more Latino. And so, and the Biden and Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are picking up fast the Latino vote, and they have a very consolidated position with Afro-Americans. So in that sense, I feel there, of course, there can still something happen. But right now, it's a few weeks already. It's more than a month that they are now are on the rise. So the it's a pretty good position, and every Democrat I speak to know that they have to fight until November, and that they, I mean, it's what Tim Walz always says: we can sleep after November 5th. And I think that says a lot about the fighting spirit, and that's a big thing in an election that big. I mean, just imagine. I mean, at least from my perspective, it's amazing that they have like Zoom calls with almost 100,000 people, you know, like when Kamala Harris announced her candidacy, the next day she had a Zoom call with 75,000 Black women to support her. I mean, that's really something, yeah, and very real, and it has carried her a long way.
Thank you very much for your interesting insights. And I'd like to delve deeper into the topic of intensity surrounding the election. And one question from the audience was, what do you anticipate in terms of the level of unrest or potential violence, particularly if Kamala Harris were to win? How intense could the reaction be compared to previous elections?
I would say more intense, and we have seen our share of violence last time around, specifically then on January 6th, where we actually were standing in the middle of it behind the Capitol when they stormed in and then stormed out afterwards, and we were attacked. But the thing is that the numbers in the U.S. show that about 8% of the population in the U.S., which amounts to like 21, 22 million people in the U.S., feel that it's justified to use violence in order to accomplish a political goal. That, I think, is supplemented by another poll that was conducted or study at the end of last year, which had even higher numbers of people who were saying that. And of course, there's always a big difference between saying something like this and then doing something like this. But our experience is that, especially among the supporters of Donald Trump, they are more radicalized. They are more willing to use violence because they really believe that the other side are communists, as Donald Trump and J.D. Vance are trying to frame them. So if there is a win by the Kamala Harris, Tim Walz team, and if it's not really a big win, then we will, in my opinion, we will see violence in several states in the U.S. We might see violence in Washington as well. The big difference is that the guy in charge is Joe Biden and the Democrats in the White House. That will make a difference in a situation like we had on January 6th. But I think they are more angry than they used to be. And if it's the other way around, if Trump wins the election, if it is a close call and there is doubt about different states, we might also see some violence from the other side, from the really far left-wing side in the U.S., because they believe that if Trump becomes president, the U.S. will turn into an authoritarian regime. They have some reason to believe that, because there are plenty of facts that we can talk about for a week that give us reason to believe that the U.S. will turn into a more authoritarian system. But some will use that also to justify violence from the left. But the danger is much bigger from the right side.
Well, I have an opinion on that, although it's not data-driven in that case. I think what we should not forget is that January 6th was only, it was a month-long campaign that led to January 6th. That didn't happen from one day to the other. And on the one side, Biden is in the White House and the security system is pretty much aware of the danger, I guess. On the other side, January 6th wouldn't have happened without January 5th. Where the Democrats won both special elections in Georgia and the majority in the Senate. So that was a culmination of many things on one date, and I'm not so sure if that is going to happen this time again, especially because if Harris and Walz win, the guy who was Mike Pence at the last time who would certify the election results is Kamala Harris herself this time. So there won't be anyone to pressure in the way that Republicans tried to pressure Mike Pence the last time. So this is one thing that speaks against a comparable spike of violence. On the other hand side, everything that Mr. Teveson said on the radicalization and on the so many people that are angry, dangerous, and have weapons, that's also a difference to Europe, obviously. That speaks for being very, very aware of the danger.
I respectfully have to disagree, because the building up of the possibility of violence has already started. Whatever Trump says during his rallies, whatever J.D. Vance adds to that, is already creating the fertile ground for violence. He's setting up the stage for saying that this election is a big fraud and it was rigged if he loses. He only will accept the election if he wins. So we already have that ramp that has started a little later back then. And believe me, I was there, and I am out in the countryside, and we meet people who, interesting enough, they believe 100% to be on the right side of history and be morally right to use violence if Donald Trump loses the election. And we will set out on an RV tour next Saturday and drive through 17 states, over 7,000 kilometers. And I'm pretty certain that we will we will feel this atmosphere, which will immediately create the possibility of violence in the swing states, in Georgia, in North Carolina, of course, also in Michigan specifically. And Donald Trump will pour oil into the fire. I'm very certain of that.
Mr. Detterson, you want to add something on this?
No, I think, you know, it's sometimes also okay, just leave the, we have spent now a long time talking about different aspects of the American election, and to this particular aspect, I don't want to add anything. It's a real danger, and it's the only thing that Merrick Garland, who is the Attorney General and is also runs the Department of Justice, is a very competent man, and that's something. And he is an expert on right wing extremism, on violent right wing extremism, and he's in charge. So that's the one point that I would say is important when it comes to the situation in Washington in January, and also I think the security services are much better prepared for a situation like that, because I was also on January 6th in front of the Capitol. What was happening on January 6th was, at least I thought in the morning, very likely, and it could have been prevented had there been security measures in place that are normally in place. So it was like surprising that it wasn't in place. And that's part of the reason why I actually feel also optimistic about the election, because what I saw on January 6th was basically the last rise of white supremacy, and it was not the future of the United States of America. And the future of the United States of America is represented by Kamala Harris, Tim Walz, and the Democratic Party as it is right now. And so that's why I think that part of American politics will have the upper hand in this election decisively, because the dynamics of American politics go in that direction and will push through. And then it will open up, I think, also a new chapter of American politics, as I said before, because then the other side has also the possibility to rethink where they want to position themselves. And I think that is the really interesting part after this election, what will come then, and it will open up new possibilities for 2028, and we can then analyze and discuss that.
I have one question for the people that Mr. Davison is obviously going to meet. I would really be interested in if the draconian punishment that many of the J6 people, in my opinion, rightfully got, I mean, many of them went to jail for years. Does that do anything to those who might be violent next time? I'm not sure if you can answer it now, but that would be really interesting to know if you meet a lot of those people, if that makes any difference for them.
Oh. Yeah, we will ask them, and I'll be happy to report back to you what we find. My guess is that it depends. If they are followers of Donald Trump, it has no deterrence whatsoever, because they are considered to be martyrs for the cause, and political prisoners, as he calls them. They celebrate them during the campaign rallies. They put them in their prayers as well. So it has some religious touch to how they see the J6 perpetrators, which in my view deserved what they got. And I don't think that it is a deterrent for the hardcore fans of Donald Trump. It will be a deterrent for other people. As a matter of fact, we see that. I mean, what happened on J6 and what the commission or the parliament then, the committee, actually in the public hearings revealed about January 6th, I think that had an impact, especially on Republicans for Harris. There is a big group of Republicans for Harris right now, because they are fed up with a candidate, Donald Trump, who is instigating violence, and they want to have that restart of the Republican Party. I'm not sure whether they're going to get it, but we'll see.
Great, thank you very much. And looking at the time, maybe conclude our interesting talk with the last question from our audience. And it's about the resignation of the independent Robert F. Kennedy. And do you think will the resignation of him support Trump now, whom he now also supports? Does it make a big difference, or is it just another brick in the wall? What do you think?
I think the numbers show, and I'm not the expert on that, but I know that Pew Research, and that is the one I rely on mostly because they have the biggest base of people they poll. It's more than 9,000 people in their polls. They only come out once a month, so I count more on them than on any other opinion polls in the U.S. because they have a much smaller base. And they say that from the 15% that Kennedy had during the last poll in August, when in July, when Biden and Trump were on the ballot with him, he had 15%. When Kamala Harris came into the race, and then in the August poll, it went down from 15 to 7%. Which means that most of his followers from those 7% came over to Kamala Harris. And possibly people who didn't want to vote for any of the old white guys. They wanted to vote for somebody different. And so they came over to Kamala Harris. Now he is out of the race entirely. I think from the other 7% or 8% he had, there is a decisive number that will go over to Donald Trump, but not, in my view, as many as he thinks, because there are people among the Kennedy followers who don't really like how he actually conducted himself in that transition now. And he has a hard time to get off the ballots. For example, in North Carolina, where he fought to get his name on the ballot, on the Stimmzettel, he is now trying to fight to get off the ballot, because if his name is still on there, people might make their cross for Kennedy and not for Trump. So it will be a lost vote for Donald Trump. So my feeling is he doesn't have really a huge impact on the outcome of the election.
I don't know if you know Celinda Lake, but she's, in my opinion, one of the best pollsters in the U.S. And I mean, she said in her latest interview that the third party candidates are now completely irrelevant for all the reasons that were just said, and that they had only an impact when Joe Biden was on the ballot and people were not enthusiastic about that choice. And since that is gone. And I think it's also very important, because I'm sometimes not clear that everybody knows. I mean, this Kennedy candidate is a crazy guy, you know. It's like, he's really out there, you know. It's like, it was an insane candidacy, an insane campaign. And he wrote on the name of the family and abused it. And at the same time, he wrote on the fact that most Americans were not happy with the choice they had, as we said at the beginning of the this discussion. And so now he's irrelevant. That's politically a positive thing.
Yeah, they say the same thing. It's pretty much 50-50. I heard the funny story of a pollster in Arizona, Nevada, who said that when they first asked who the Kennedy supporters were, when he was above 10%, they found out that demographically his voters were much more Democratic than Republican. And then when they asked the deciding question, who would you vote for in a four- or five-way race, and then who would you vote for in a direct race between the two, they would split evenly. So I didn't see any other data point in from any serious polling firm. There's not only Pew Research, but Pew Research is definitely one of the best ones, and everyone says that it doesn't really matter. And he would have come down to 2 or 3% anyway, because also people who said that they would vote for him were not very much informed about him. And the more they knew about the guy, and the more they would be taught his program and what he would stand for, he would have gone down anyway. But if he would have stayed in, 2% could decide the race. Ask Al Gore about that.
So thank you very much. This was really a deep dive on US elections. I really enjoyed it. I hope you as well. Thank you all for joining us tonight and for your insightful contributions to the discussion. It's been a great session. I appreciate everyone's participation. And I'll now hand it back to Michael Sinknell for the final remarks.
Thank you very much, David. Thanks a lot to your wonderful moderation. Many thanks also to our excellent speakers. I fully agree with you. That was indeed a very deep dive into the details of the election. I very much appreciated the diverse discussion that we've had, various angles of expertise that we covered. I personally believe that one of the questions that is of utmost importance is the question of violence and whether or not there will be a violent outburst. This is, of course, something that we will also closely follow, because I suppose it will have ramifications for the political environment of the United States, probably for a long-term future, in which direction politically the US is developing towards. However, please stay tuned. This is not going to be the only discussion that we are having on the topic of transatlantic talks. We will certainly have more such sessions online or in hybrid format throughout the next couple of weeks, couple of months. The next one is already actually around the corner, so planned. With that having said, thanks a lot again on behalf of the Austrian Institute for European and Security Policy to all our participants, to all our contributors today, to the supporters of this session, and looking forward to continuing this extremely relevant discussion. Thanks a lot.